Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So much for California dreaming. It was such a winter's day today. All kinds of snow and rain. But the biggest storm may be just days away, and it won't start in the Pacific, but in Sacramento, where lawmakers just can't seem to close a $42 billion budget gap. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing people-ready enterprise solutions, software based on how people really work. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives at speakingoffaith.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this President's Day. It is Monday, the 16th of February. Here in California, we produce almost $2 trillion worth of goods and services. That makes the Golden State's economy the eighth largest in the world. But the recession, coupled with entrenched political gridlock, has our fair state in not-so-fair straits. Legislators have been trying for nearly 4 months to pass a budget that would close a $42 billion deficit. After pulling an all-weekender in Sacramento, they again failed to reach a deal last night and were back at the table today. But there are dire predictions that the state could run out of money within days. We asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to find out what a bankrupt California might look like.
Unlike the federal government, states can't run a deficit. So if a budget isn't passed soon, state leaders say California would have to shut down billions of dollars worth of public works projects and hand out IOUs instead of tax refunds. California Treasury spokesman Tom Dressler.
California is one of the top 10 economies in the world, and we are standing at the poorhouse door.
Dressler says the budget delay has already forced California to suspend more than 5,000 infrastructure projects. Now investors are worried the state will go bankrupt and default on its debts. Standard & Poor's has already given Golden State bonds the lowest rating of any state. But Nick Johnson, with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, says there's no way California would default.
It's hard to imagine. It would make it really hard for the state to sell bonds to finance infrastructure improvements or day-to-day operations, which would really imperil the state's economic future.
Johnson says the state would withhold funding to education, healthcare, and prisons before it would fail to pay back bondholders, and that no state has defaulted on its bonds in more than 100 years. Nearly every state is facing a massive budget shortfall. Johnson says it's the political infighting that's made California's budget problem stand out. And that's what businesses and investors will remember, even if a budget is passed soon, says economist Stephen Levy, who studies California's economy.
We're looking like the state that can't get its act together. The ongoing budget political gridlock is both embarrassing, and I think it'll have a long-term cost in terms of the confidence of investors in our bonds.
Levy says California's budget fight goes back a decade, when the dot-com bubble burst and Republicans and Democrats couldn't agree on where to trim. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
As Stacey mentioned, California has quite a bit of company when it comes to budget woes. Today, Kansas suspended income tax refunds, and it warned state employees that they may not get paid on time this Friday. So far, there's no talk of Michigan sliding into bankruptcy, but the state's main industry is back on the brink. Tomorrow is the deadline for General Motors and Chrysler to submit restructuring plans to Congress and the White House. Today, President Barack Obama said instead of a so-called car czar, a task force on autos will be appointed to deal with the industry's troubles. It'll be co-chaired by Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and Chief Economic Advisor Lawrence Summers. Why the switch? Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
The Obama administration decided the problem was bigger than a single car czar, since the crisis in the auto industry ripples across all sorts of industrial, labor, and environmental policies. So one day before GM and Chrysler are to submit their restructuring plans to the Treasury Department, the White House unveiled an interagency task force. University of San Francisco management professor John Fisher agrees a task force will be more effective, but he worries about the implementation.
So I think the fact that they switched gears so close to the deadline is an indication that they don't quite have their story straight.
To see their way out of a downward spiral, Fisher says the companies will have to squeeze more concessions from all sorts of stakeholders, part suppliers, workers, bondholders. And so far that hasn't happened, says Peter Cohen, the author of a book on Boeing's restructuring.
There's a lot of unprofitable product lines. There's excessive dealerships. There's excessive factory capacity relative to the amount of demand.
White House aides have begun to raise the possibility that bankruptcy is the only viable way to make such drastic cuts. But Republican Congressman Thaddeus McCotter says that would be disastrous for his constituents in Southeast Michigan.
We have always had the position here in the Midwest that bankruptcy was not an option, not only for the long-term survival of the companies, but more importantly for the retirees and the working people that are still employed in it.
McCotter expects the companies and their unions will make the sacrifices necessary to avoid bankruptcy. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Fallout from the global meltdown may be whacking Japan more than any other country. Today, the land of the rising sun reported its economy is in retrograde, shrinking at an annual clip of almost 13%. For comparison, the U.S. economy is contracting at a rate of about 4%. Japan's latest numbers came on the same day as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton touched down in Tokyo. For her first trip as top U.S. diplomat, she's touring Asia, because long-term, that's where the global balance of economic power is shifting. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
It may be hard to see Japan pulling the world out of this ditch, because it's stuck too. The Japanese economy is in its worst shape since 1974. Still, Tokyo has $1 trillion in reserve. And it's sharing. Bill Belshear is with Macquarie Securities.
You saw the $100 billion they're loaning to the IMF and others for their programs in parts of the world that are more distressed. They are a rich country.
And Secretary Clinton may ask Tokyo to keep cutting those checks. Her other big stop is Beijing, which has even deeper pockets. Today, the secretary praised China's $600 billion stimulus package. And fact is, China is one of the only big economies still growing, still buying stuff. Like U.S. Treasuries. Jing Tanrong teaches at Renmin University.
At the moment, treasury bonds are still a good choice. But from long-term viewpoint, there are some different opinions in China.
As in, some advisors want to unload dollars, and China holds $1 trillion of them. Beijing also frets about the Buy America clause in the U.S. stimulus package. And for its part, Washington has attacked China for setting its currency too low. Beijing consultant David Wolf predicts a lot of venting.
The Chinese have an old saying, Bu da bu cheng jiao. You cannot really be true friends until you've had a chance to roll up your sleeves and throw punches at each other.
These friends need to revamp their relationship. Before the meltdown, the Chinese overproduced and Americans overconsumed. So much for the good old days. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And late-breaking news from elsewhere in radio land. The Wall Street Journal reports that Liberty Media is near a deal to buy a significant stake in Sirius XM. The satellite radio company warned last week that it could file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection as early as tomorrow without some help for its debt problems. Wall Street took the holiday off today. We'll look at how the rest of the world fared when we do the numbers. We've already discussed the ongoing woes of the U.S. auto industry. Well, it's not just American cars facing tough times. Toyota announced last week that it's looking to cut costs, but it's trying to do so without cutting people. Instead, it's trimming pay and hours. Lots of companies are looking into this option as a way to avoid layoffs. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports on how organizations weigh the pros and cons.
If you had the choice between a pay cut of, say, 10% and layoffs at your company, which would you pick?
I would take a pay cut because I don't want to see anybody else go.
I'd take a little pay cut. I'd feel better about myself and if I was helping out the company, but I don't know if everyone's like me.
They're not.
I'd prefer laying people off because I think that there are plenty of people at my firm who aren't carrying their weight.
The problem is 39% of companies have already trimmed their workforces. That's according to a recent survey by the human resources firm Watson Wyatt. But Laura Siegen, one of the firm's practice directors, says for many companies, layoffs are only part of the story.
Either before resorting to layoffs or in addition to layoffs, companies are trying other tactics. So they're doing a hiring freeze, or they're doing a salary freeze, or they're putting restrictions in place on company travel.
Or they're cutting salaries. The Watson Wyatt survey found 5% of companies have already done so, a number that is expected to double in the coming year. Jo Prabhu thinks that's an understatement. She runs the recruiting firm International Services Group.
In this current economy, there is no yardstick. Layoffs are happening daily. Companies are reorganizing daily because there is no money, there is no credit, there is no way for them to pay their salaries.
Prabhu says just as home values were too high during the boom, some salaries were too high. And now they're correcting.
Actually, this happened to my son. His salary was being cut by 15%, and he asked me to look for other positions for him. But the fact of the matter is I advised him to stay within his current job because the possibility of him getting another job with the same or higher salary is almost slim to none.
The choice between layoffs and pay cuts isn't easy for managers either. Some see layoffs as better for morale because everyone affected is gone. Psychologist Ken DeMeese has been studying the workplace for decades. He says layoffs can lead to stress and guilt for employees who stick around. That means reduced productivity and higher health care costs for the company. DeMeese says cutting pay means everyone feels the pain.
But it does tend to foster how can we work together to save our company, to save our jobs, rather than creating a situation of haves and have-nots.
DeMeese says research shows that for a pay cut to work, it's got to happen from top to bottom. Executives have to share in the pain.
Secondly, there has to be a communication that it's temporary, that once the economy turns around, that your pay will be brought back to the level it once was and hopefully increased because you've shown good faith to stay with this company and now we're going to compensate you accordingly.
Whatever the payoff is in the future, experts say all Americans should brace for the possibility of salary cuts because right now it's definitely an employer's market. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Here's an upside-down way of looking at all this dismal layoff news. The stigma is pretty much gone from the pink slip. Now, I'm not saying it's easy to lose your job, but certainly no one is going to be surprised or think you somehow screwed up. The evidence is right there on the new blog entry. Hey, everyone, change of status. I'm unemployed. This is the first recession, really, since the explosion of social media. As Kurt Nickisch reports from WBUR in Boston, people are also using those social networks to get hired.
Dave Atkins was working from home the day his boss called. Company meeting. Half the people at a small internet startup were going to lose their jobs.
I happened to be on Twitter at the time. I said, hey, it looks like I'm getting laid off. Immediately, people started looking for ways to help me.
He blogged about it, too. He posted his resume and recommendations on a professional networking website.
Help Dave find work following his layoff, and there's a link to my LinkedIn profile.
Now, Atkins spends hours each day at his computer, which chirps with new email and instant messages. He says his job search isn't that different from the old-fashioned way. Networking online just makes it easier.
I'm having lots of meetings with people, but now I think the meetings are better because sometimes you just really connect with people through a shared interest that wouldn't be obvious from just cold calling them on the phone or just meeting them in person with no context.
According to networking consultant Diane Darling, Atkins has the modern job search down.
What I call hybrid networking, and it's where you combine online and offline networking.
It helps that Atkins works in tech, but no matter what color your collar, Darling says, social media can help you find opportunities. It also helps employers find out more about you.
Before Google, there was gossip. You had no idea. Now you can get a little bit of a better sense of what people are saying. And I think it's important that you manage that, your own reputation.
And there's another reason managing the job search could be hard without social networks. Ted Challoner runs a Boston recruiting firm. He says many companies that are hiring right now, they're not even posting their positions. because if they do, they just get swamped with applications.
Getting it from the thousands and thousands to the 20 or 10 or 5, I think is the problem that companies are facing.
So in order to find a job, Challoner says you may have to use social networks just to find a job opening first. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Coming up, buying less for more.
Of course. It's deceptive. Yeah. They don't bring out a big ad and say, we're going to charge you more or the same and give you 2 ounces less.
But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed for the President's Day holiday, but Asian markets saw a lot of action, most of it on the downside. News that Japan's economy shrank more than 3% in the fourth quarter sent its stock average tumbling. The Nikkei fell 29 points, 0.4%, to close at 7,750. Adding to the downward pressure, Japanese electronics maker Pioneer Corporation shed 13 cents, 8.5%, after an announcement last week that it will exit the flat panel TV business. Shares in Toyota, Canon, and Sony also fell. But Japan's news didn't faze China. The Shanghai Composite Index hit a 5.5-month high, jumping 68 points, 3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Tuesday. Chrysler and GM will present cost-cutting plans to Congress to see whether or not they get to keep their billions of bailout dollars. More than 100 television stations will be making the switch from analog to digital. Congress pushed back the deadline for all TV stations to June 12th. And on President's Day in 1801, Thomas Jefferson squeaked by Aaron Burr to be elected the third president of the United States. I'm Caitlin Finaro.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. It is too late for Valentine's Day, but if you've got an investor in the family with a birthday coming up, how about a Smash Me Bernie? For $99.95, you too can own a piece of Wall Street history. A pitchfork-wielding Bernie Madoff doll debuted at this week's Toy Fair in New York. It's packaged with a hammer to, I'll refer you to the doll's title. If you're not feeling so violent, perhaps you might take some scissors to your brokerage statements. With all that paper money just vanished, you'd be forgiven for wondering if the entire market is a Ponzi scheme. Roger Lowenstein mulled this over recently in the New York Times, and I asked him to explain how Madoff and the S&P 500 could be one and the same.
Yeah, sure. Let's think, Tess, a little bit about how the stock market works, because, you know, we all say we're investing in these companies. We buy GE, we buy Google, and if those companies do well, we make money, right? But if you think about it, they don't send us a check just because their profits go up. Once in a while they do, maybe with dividends. But
right,
the way most of us get our reward day in, day out, is because the stock goes up, and we can sell at a higher price. And what does that mean, the stock goes up? It means other people are coming in and bidding it up. So, you know, at least in the short term, even us normal investors, people who wouldn't associate ourselves with people who invested in Bernie Madoff, we're dependent on other people coming in and buying those stocks. And in an absolute sense, that's what a Ponzi scheme is.
But at least we think that we're investing in something besides air, right?
Well, we are. I mean, I think you're asking me, isn't there really a difference? And yes, there is a difference, because underneath the Ponzi scheme, as you said, there's nothing but air. In the long term, you know, when you invest in the stock market, you do own a share of a productive enterprise, and they have the power to pay dividends. And by long term, that ought to mean that you think this is a good business. It's got a good franchise. It has, you know, customer base and so on. And the point I was making is, if you're very dependent on the short term, let's just say you got to sell by next Tuesday, you're going to sell on Tuesday or Wednesday at 3:30, whatever it is, you're really on the hook for whether other people come in or not.
When we think of the short term versus the long term, I wonder if that definition has changed at all because of the economic crisis. I love your point in the article where you say, look, if you are actually watching what is going on from day to day, even month to month in this thing, you are not truly in it for the long term. What is the long term?
Well, you know, I don't think it's that the definition has changed so much. It's how we perceive it has changed because of how things are going. When markets were going up, and it was a good long time where with some fluctuations along the way, they mostly did go up. Everybody's a true blue, gut religion, a long-term investor. I can withstand the downturn,
right.
Yada, yada, yada. But I think what we're seeing now, not so much the definition of the term or the long-term has changed, is we're realizing what it really means to withstand the fluctuations or the down periods. This is a pretty severe down period. And so, you know, while we may have said to ourselves and others, we're in it for the long haul, I don't think we really tested ourselves or understood what that can mean.
Then it sounds like maybe we do need to change our notion of what the long term is. If we're not factoring in a market like we've seen over the last year, then maybe we're not as long term as we think we are.
You really have to know why you're in a stock. If you're investing long term, it's got to be money that you're not going to need in 8, 12, even 24 months. You know, if you're worried because you're going to have to pull that money out to pay college tuition or something, that money shouldn't be in the stock market. Never should have been in the stock market.
It really seems, for so many of us, so hard to trust this notion of the long term after what we've been through over the last 6 months, even if we're nowhere near retirement. How do we get ourselves in the frame of mind to believe in the market again?
Well, it's, you know, just as it's very hard when things are going great, it really would have been impossible to have convinced someone that of all the trauma and loss that was just around the corner, it's very hard at bottoms or at troughs to believe that things will ever get better. But, you know, Warren Buffett has said it, when people are fearful, be greedy.
Roger Lowenstein is an outside director of the Sequoia Fund and also a regular contributor to the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Great talking to you.
If you're one of the lucky folks who have the day off today, perhaps you're using it to check some errands off your to-do list. If one of those errands is a run to the grocery store, beware of the shrink. Not the couch shrink, not the shrink wrap. No, I am talking about product shrinkage. Many companies are reducing the size and weight of everything from cereal boxes to soda cans. But if you're expecting reduced prices to go along with the reduced package, yeah, right. Is this a subtle way to raise prices? Definitely. Is it deceptive? Here's Marketplace's Sean Cole.
The poster product for this phenomenon is Skippy peanut butter. The regular sized jar looks the same as always, until you turn it upside down.
The jar used to have a smooth bottom. It now has an indentation, which takes a couple of ounces of peanut butter out of the product.
Frank Luby is a marketing and pricing consultant for Simon Kucher & Partners in Cambridge, Mass. He says that big dimple in the bottom of the Skippy jar
allows them to keep the same price point, but you get slightly less.
I guess my follow-up question to all of this is, what the hell? Is that okay?
To be perfectly honest, I think it is okay.
With the price of commodities going up this year, Luby says, shrinking containers might be the lesser of three evils. The other two being cheaper ingredients, which would change the taste of your peanut butter, or alienating even the most loyal customers with higher shelf prices. Now, Skippy is made by Unilever, a food conglomerate that also put a dent in the bottom of Hellman's mayonnaise and shrank your carton of Breyer's ice cream. No one there would go on tape, but when I raised the deception question, a spokesman said the new weight is clearly marked on the package. And Frank Luby says the per ounce and per pound labels on the grocery shelf really help.
So Yes, it's deceptive, but I think it would be even more deceptive if you didn't have that level playing field that's created by the per-ounce comparisons, which we can take a close look at when we go to the supermarket.
The supermarket down the road from his office.
And I want to go look at the box of Total.
Total cereal, his brand.
I grabbed this box, and this is relatively thin.
It looks really thin.
It looks really thin.
Whereas the face of the box looks as wide as always. General Mills, which makes Total, told me it only shrank down some of its cereal sizes, that the smaller ones are now cheaper, and that this is old news. And as Luby and I were checking out that famous dent in the Skippy jar...
How deep is that, would you say?
It's probably as deep as a fingernail.
We got kicked out of the store.
Okay, I can't even do any recording in the store or filming without permission from headquarters.
Okay. Do you mind if I buy these?
You can buy them, yeah.
Okay, great.
So I went to the checkout counter with two boxes of Total and a jar of Skippy.
Oh, $11.27, wow.
Way more than I thought it was going to cost.
Okay, I'm whipping out $2 more here.
All the money in my wallet. And Luby says that proves the point.
You're going to remember that that cost you more than what you expected, and that's going to stick with you. But the package sizes, to the extent that you knew them anyway before you started working on this story, will continue to fade.
But I'm not so sure. Because I went to another grocery store, bought a bunch of downsized items, and did a little show-and-tell with folks in the parking lot. Peggy Pellegrino and her friend June Mackey were so mad about this issue, you could barely understand them.
Oh, they all are. With the hole peanut butter, on the bottom, like this. Mayonnaise.
So you know about this?
Yeah. Of course we do.
Really?
We're sure informed consumers.
It's disgusting, Peggy said. Disgusting. But is it deceptive, I said.
Of course. It's deceptive. Yeah. They don't bring out a big ad and say, we're going to charge you more or the same. And give you 2 ounces less.
Not only
they
that.
They make you find out for yourself.
Not only that, it's harder to scrape it out at the bottom with the indented things.
Others in the parking lot had a different take. They said consumers have to watch out for themselves. But pretty much everyone said they'd rather just pay more for the original sized products. Oh, and this radio story was reduced from 4.5 minutes to 3:15. So in Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, a warning, actually, not to let your fingers do the walking in Vegas. State gambling regulators have sent an alert to casinos to watch for folks who are spending a little too much time checking their iPhones while doubling down on 13 at the blackjack table. Apparently, there's an iPhone app that can help you count cards. Now, if you do it in your head, it's not illegal, though according to the movies, it'll get you tossed out the front door by big lugs and dark shades. But using a device to do the counting, well, that is a felony. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets were closed today in observance of President's Day and will reopen tomorrow. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, how this recession has put auto parts makers behind the airbag.
That's where you really have to watch your inventory, make sure you have as little as possible, but are still able to meet the requirements.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.